believe that all of this was planned as a strategy to get to China, for a bunch of different reasons. One is, the unique adversarial relationship between China and the U.S. is well known, and it's been going on since the first trade war. So there's really no new information to be learned. The second is that the Chinese and the U.S. had actually been negotiating, and the Chinese had shown themselves to be really willing to negotiate and really not desiring a trade war. So you see that, for example, in the negotiations over the TikTok deal. So under the Biden administration, it was TikTok was asked to divorce itself from its Chinese owners, ByteDance. At the time, the Chinese government said, no way, we'll never let ByteDance sell TikTok to Americans. But then under the Trump administration, what we saw was that, the negotiations proceeded quite rapidly. And 2 days before it became official, that's when the US hiked up tariffs on China to another 34%. So that just doesn't feel like a well-planned strategy. Another way to ask it is to say, well, what has the US government achieved now that it couldn't have achieved without raising tariffs for the entire world, right? What did it achieve by increasing tariffs for, islands with only penguins on it? What was the point of that? Did that tell anyone anything about American strength or about China? And the answer has to be no.
There's that cartoon going around. First, they came for the cats, then they came for the penguins. They're mean.
I wanted to ask about the broader implications of what it would mean for a massive cut in trade between the U.S. and China. The World Trade Organization said Wednesday that this escalating tariff war could cut trade in goods between the two countries by 80%, and trade between China and the U.S. accounts for 3% of global trade, all global trade. So what would that mean? What are the fallout effects of that on other countries, much smaller economies? Professor Stiglitz, this point that you made about the U.S. having broken international economic law, Bernie Sanders issued a statement yesterday saying that what he's done is actually unconstitutional, that Trump does not have the authority to impose the tariffs that he has. So if you could comment on both those things.
So let me begin by first emphasizing there's going to be a big economic effect on the United States because the time it takes to bring manufacturing back in the United States, even if he were successful, is not 3 months, not even a year, 2 years. I've talked to firms that have thought about bringing manufacturing back to the United States. They say, we don't have the logistics, we don't have the supply chains that you need to bring complex manufacturing back. And modern manufacturing is robotic. So even if we brought manufacturing back, there are not going to be many jobs. So the reality is that his picture of bringing us back to the 1950s, that's never going to happen. But what's going to happen in the meanwhile? We're not going to be able to get those goods that Americans want. We saw what happened when the supply chains got interrupted after the pandemic and after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Prices soared, some goods more than others. And that's the world we're going to be back in. That's going to affect, of course, not only the United States, but every other country. If the Fed acts like it normally does, when prices go up, it raises interest rates, we're going to go back into
Who is
stagflation.
Trump's ear? I mean, you've got the trade whisperer, Peter Navarro, right, who was, top economic trade guy in the first administration, then went to prison, is now out, and continually cites the economist Ron Barrow for why it's important to trade to impose tariffs. And it turns out that Ron Barrow is just an anagram of Navarro. He doesn't even exist. You can't make this stuff up. And now, of course, Donald Trump would call reporters for years as John Barron. So it's very similar, also a fictional person. In fact, it was Donald Trump. So who is advising him? And what about the fact that people like Elon Musk joined with the broligarchy, the other billionaires, against what he was doing, attacked Navarro nonstop, calling him a moron and a sack of bricks, but said that was an insult to bricks?
Well, I mean, there is no one that he seems to be listening to. In many ways, Trump is giving protectionism a bad name. There is an argument that you can say that carefully constructed policies can help build particular industries.
So UAW President Sean Fain makes that argument.
Yeah. In particular industries, it has to be crafted. More important for developing countries than developed. We don't need that as much as a poor developing country. But sometimes you can use carefully crafted trade policies to do that. But his broad-based policies, his going after Canada, his going after the penguins, makes absolutely no sense. And what he's bringing back is the concern that we've had, that political economists have had for a very long time. It can be a source of corruption. When you negotiate in a non-transparent way, what happens is bribes get paid. You say, take off my tariff and I'll give you money. Money either directly to you or to your campaign coffers. Mm-hmm. So we're going back into a non-transparent world where, for instance, the billionaire tech bros can help shape global tech policy in international trade to the detriment of the entire world. He's already done that. He's made a big deal about the EU changing its laws that try to create competition in the tech sphere to try to make sure that there's AI safety and social media safety, content moderation. He's attacked these fundamental laws, and all this is going to be going on in secret and with a lot of dirty stuff.
And just boasts like he did the other night. I've got all these countries kissing my, I won't say it, but it rhymes with grass. You know what I mean?
Okay. And just before we conclude, Professor Chan, if you could give us an idea, what is happening in China? What are you hearing about how industries there are preparing for what's to come?
So China, the voices in China are surprisingly calm. You know, the government's trying to strike a balance between preparing the people for economic pains to come and getting people into a mindset of solidarity. You know, they're blaming this these tariff hikes on the Trump administration and the U.S. government. And people find that convincing in this case. At the same time, they're also trying to not stir up too much nationalism. So they've been really careful to actually censor how high the tariff hikes have been by the U.S. They've been careful. And, you know, my reading of what's going on is that they're creating space so that they can get out of this, right? So that there's a face-saving way to negotiate and get out of this trade war if an opportunity presents itself. And, you know, in the meantime, of course, the central bankers, the industries, everyone is lining themselves up for a deep and long trade war.
I want to thank you, Nancy Chen, for joining us, professor of economics at Northwestern University in Chicago, but joining us from Rome, Italy, and Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist and professor at Columbia University. Coming up, we look at President Trump's latest threats to bomb Iran just days before the U.S. and Iran hold talks in Oman. Stay with us.
Well, I'm sitting over here on Parchment Farm. Well, I'm sitting over here on Parchment Farm. Well, I'm sitting over here on Parchment Farm, and I ain't never done no man no harm. Putting that cotton in an 11-foot sack. 7-foot sack. Well, I'm putting that cotton in a 11-foot sack with a 12-gauge shotgun at my back.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
The U.S. and Iran are planning to hold talks this weekend in Oman. President Trump made the announcement on Monday. He said direct talks will be held, while Iran said they would be indirect talks. Presidential envoy Steve Witkoff will head the U.S. delegation. Iran is sending its foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi. In 2018, Trump withdrew the United States from the landmark Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. On Monday, Trump directly threatened Iran when he was asked what will happen if a new nuclear deal is not reached.
If diplomacy fails, is the United States, under your leadership, ready to take military action to destroy the Iranian nuclear program and remove this threat?
I think if the talks aren't successful with Iran, I think Iran is going to be in great danger. And I hate to say it, great danger, because they can't have a nuclear weapon.
So is that a yes?
You know, it's not a complicated formula. Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. That's all there is.
President Trump was sitting in the Oval Office on Monday with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu when he said that. Trump said Israel yesterday. He said Israel would take a leading role if the U.S. went ahead with striking Iran.
With Iran, if it requires military, we're going to have military. Israel will obviously be very much involved in that. He'll be the leader of that. But nobody leads us. We do what we want to do.
The Trump administration's also levied new sanctions against Iran, targeting its uranium enrichment program. We're joined right now by Nagar Mortazeh, the Iranian-American journalist, host of the Iran podcast, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Nagar, welcome back to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me.
If you could start off by responding to what President Trump is threatening and what you know of these talks taking place in Oman on Saturday.
Sure. So, Amy, it seems like President Trump is kind of using his usual and specifically first-term playbook of what they have themselves coined peace through strength, or trying to get to the negotiating table or to diplomacy via threats. Which in this case is military threats. We saw him do the same in his first term against Iran, with North Korea, with other parties that he wants to get to the negotiating table and feels like the other side doesn't come to the table. And so with threats and with pressure, he thinks he can force them. I think, though, the experience of the first Trump term, when it was maximum pressure on the other side, didn't really work with the Iranians and backfired. And there may have been some lessons learned. We see that he's fired some of the main figures of the maximum pressure Iran campaign, Mike Pompeo, John Bolton, Brian Hook. They're no longer with him. He's publicly disassociated with them. And so it seems like this time, his really intent on diplomacy, on a deal with Iran, on a deal that he's been trying to say is going to be a better deal, that the Obama-era deal was a bad one, and his is going to be better. And potentially, I guess, a Nobel Peace Prize is something that he has his eyes on if he can get this nuclear deal with Iran, which he's called a nuclear peace deal. But at the same time, we've seen that it's difficult for him to get to the negotiating table with the Iranians, and so the pressure and these threats are also coming with it parallel. So it's a strange methodology to try to convince the other side with threats and pressure. And that's one of the reasons the Iranians are not willing to sit down directly and negotiate directly. And this emphasis on indirect negotiations is because they're also saying, look, you want to negotiate and have diplomacy, which is something Tehran has indicated they want as well. But at the same time, you're increasing maximum pressure. Just yesterday, as you said, Amy, they put on more sanctions on Iran. Since he came into office, he signed a memorandum of maximum pressure to tighten sanctions and pressure on Iran, and there have been periodic sanctions imposed on the Iranians. So It's not exactly the best way to get to the negotiating table, but nevertheless, this is his style, and the Iranians have played ball to meet with them on Saturday in Oman, but that's one of the main reasons it's going to be indirect, because the Iranian side is basically signaling that they want to see some goodwill. They also want to understand the framework and the U.S.'s bottom line of what it is that they want. Because if you listen to President Trump and, for example, Steve Witkoff, the structure or the framework they've talked about is Iran not having nuclear weapons, just not having nuclear weapons, which is something Tehran has agreed to before, and they've actually said they don't want nuclear weapons. But if you listen, for example, to National Security Advisor Michael Waltz, or Benjamin Netanyahu going out of the White House and some other people in that orbit, they're saying a dismantlement, an entire dismantlement of Iran's nuclear program. Basically, Iran can't have a nuclear program, period. So which is it? I think that is also going to sort of show the way on Saturday to the Iranians.
So, Nigar, also, if you could talk about what the situation is, the economic context in which these negotiations are taking place in Iran, the enormous economic pressure that's been brought to bear on Iran over all these years of sanctions now exponentially multiplied, and the fact that in an unprecedented move, the Iranian president, Masoud Pezeshkian, has said that if a deal is reached, American companies could come and invest in Iran.
Sure. So let me start with the latest. The Iranian president, again, exactly as you said, unprecedented, has said that the supreme leader himself is open to American companies coming to Iran and investing. And this is, again, signal to President Trump, because his criticism, one of his main criticisms of the JCPOA, President Obama's legacy nuclear deal with Iran, was that the Europeans were reaping all the benefits and not Americans. And this is mainly, it's not something that Iran has started. It's something that American companies can't do because of very strict U.S. sanctions. American companies can't have trade with Iran or any form of investment because of the punishment that the U.S. government will impose on them in the form of sanctions. In fact, secondary sanctions now have prevented other companies around the world, Europeans, Asians, many others, to these sanctions if they do trade with Iran. So if that's something that President Trump wants, he can change that. Iran had a deal to buy airplanes, passenger airplanes from Boeing, and even that was stopped from happening, which essentially Boeing took an economic hit for that. As far as the economic situation in Iran, well, the economy is in pretty bad shape, declining as a direct result of these harsh economic sanctions. Iran is one of the most, if not the most, one of the most sanctioned countries in the world right now by the U.S., as I said, these primary and secondary sanctions, which even punish non-American companies who do trade with Iran if you buy Iranian oil, gas. As a result of that, Iran has a lot of its assets sitting in reserves, basically blocked outside the country. For example, the Iraqis buy a lot of energy from Iran, but they owe the money in billions to Iran because the U.S. doesn't allow them to pay Iran back. And so it's a combination of this cutoff. Iran's being cut off from the world economy, or most of it, that has really impacted the state of affairs and the living situation for ordinary Iranians, working class, middle class Iranians. The life, basically, their
we have 30
purchasing
seconds.
Power has shrinked.
Nigar, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Nigar Mortazevi is an Iranian-American journalist, host of the Iran podcast, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Of course, we'll cover this more following the talks in Oman on Saturday. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
There's a nip in the air. It's the chill of fear and despair that is all too familiar to me. The recent Columbia graduate student Mahmoud Khalil's detention by Immigration and Customs Enforcement on Saturday has brought back my most tormenting childhood nightmares as a child of Holocaust survivors in communist Romania in the 1950s. Those are the words of our next guest, Marianna Hirsch, professor emerita at Columbia University. In her recent article headlined, "I grew up under a terrifying authoritarian regime. Mahmoud Khalil's arrest is right out of their playbook." The article was published in the Jewish newspaper, The Forward.
Marianna Hirsch joins us today in studio. She's the author of several books, including The Generation of Post-Memory, Writing in Visual Culture After the Holocaust. Professor Hirsch, welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. You said the conditions for Mahmoud Khalil's arrest were created by Columbia, and then put that into the larger context, you having come out of authoritarian Romania.
Well, I grew up in Romania until the age of 12. My parents were survivors of the Romanian Holocaust. And when Mahmoud Khalil was abducted, when Rumeza Öztürk was abducted, and I watched those videos, it brought back these feelings of terror that I grew up with as a child, the helplessness in front of seemingly all-powerful forces that couldn't be stopped, that were arbitrary, and that had only the barest rationale for, or no rationale, for these arrests. I think the condition for these arrests have been created by our universities. Unfortunately, Columbia, where I teach and where I've taught for 20 years, was the model for this. And the way they've been created is, first of all, by accepting and then promoting the big lie that anti-Semitism is driving protests against the brutal genocidal war in Gaza, of Israel on Gaza, that these are anti-Semitic protests of excluding and suspending student groups, of draconian measures of punishment, but also of casting protesters as terrorists, which is now expanding. And what I'm seeing is spread is the kind of helplessness that I felt as a child and that I picked up from my surroundings, the fear of speaking, the suspicion that one can be denounced, that there are lists out there, that we don't know who's on the lists, that that there's nothing that can be done to help. And I'm seeing my students silence themselves, being afraid to speak, wondering who might be denouncing them, who might be making lists. And let's be real. I mean, Mahmoud Khalil was chosen by Columbia to be a mediator between the administration and the student protesters. And then he was denounced by, unfortunately, I have to say, people at Columbia. There's a Intercept report that I'm sure you're aware of, that there's a group of parents, alumni, and even some faculty who are making lists of students who could be deported who are aliens, enemies of the state, of the university. And this idea of denunciation is something that I've carried from my childhood, because my father would often come home saying that he was asked by his superiors at work whether he would name the names of people who, whatever. I mean, there was always a reason for this, and how he refused, and how, you know, he gave up some possibilities of advancement by refusing to name those names. So this is something I was carrying. But there is a difference. You know, we have laws. This is illegal. And there are possibilities of appeal. And there are also ways in which this narrative, this big lie of rampant anti-Semitism that universities have accepted and even promoted by forming task forces on anti-Semitism, I think there are people who are now seeing, Jerry Nadler is a great example, that this might not have been such a good idea, because it's brought upon us this terrible repression under the guise of fighting anti-Semitism. And I think people are now saying that this is not just morally completely wrong and corrupt, but that it's also not good for Jews, certainly, but it's that it's not good for anybody, and that the reason for this was never to fight anti-Semitism, but it was to decimate academia.
And if you could talk, you've also written a piece on the extent to which and the speed with which Colombia completely capitulated or submitted to the Trump administration's demands. You wrote a piece headlined, "There's a bleak historical explanation for why Colombia's capitulation to Trump is so concerning," in which you write, quote, "We are not living in early Nazi Germany, but although as a student of fascism and the Holocaust, I've learned to be careful with such comparisons, some resonances are too obvious to ignore." What are those resonances?
Well, the resonances are that autocratic regimes go after education. I mean, certainly higher education. Why? Well, academic freedom, self-governance, inquiry, open inquiry, the possibility that we might promote a narrative of history that is true, but that doesn't conform to the vision of the autocrat. All of those things are extremely threatening, and we've seen it not just in early Nazi Germany, but certainly in Hungary, in Turkey, in India, the crackdown on universities. But what's more concerning to me is the response of universities and how they've not just anticipatory obedience, but really anticipatory capitulation, first through these task forces and accepting the anti-Semitism narrative, but then agreeing to the demands, which are completely illegal and unreasonable demands, in the hope of pacifying the autocrat, which I think everybody already should know that that is not how you can deal. So what I'm not seeing is solidarity among universities, the willingness or the eagerness to fight back and to say, no way, we're not going to stand for this.
And finally, Mariani, you've worked on the transmission of memories of violence across generations, what you call post-memory. How do you see that? You've expressed concerns, in particular, Mahmoud Khalil's unborn child, the children of Gaza. How do you see this kind of being acted out now and in the future, all the violence that we see happening now? And also, I should mention the hundreds of student visas that we know of international students that have been revoked.
Well, this revocation, just to start with that, completely arbitrary, and students are not even informed, and the university is not informed. They find out through the online system. And then the ostracism of these students, which is what happened to me as a child and certainly to my parents, of being denationalized, of being ostracized and publicly shamed for, you know, as a child I was a pioneer with the red scarf, and I saw some of my classmates their red scarves were forcibly removed in front of the entire school when their parents applied for visas to leave, the country. So that's, you know, something I carry as a child. But I'm also carrying what I call post-memory, which is memories of violence across generations that I inherited from my parents' stories. These are vicarious, but they feel like memories. And that's why I thought I needed a term for these very powerful fears and terrors that children, you know, that we inherit for experiences that we didn't ourselves live, but that we feel like we remembered. So I guess the fear right now is that it's not only the children right now, but it's it's the future generations that will, how they will receive this moment of fear that is spreading across the country with people losing visas, losing status, even the stories of green card holders, but citizens possibly, and naturalized citizens like me, possibly being denationalized and like you. So I think the reverberations of this could reach future generations, and what we're transmitting is extremely concerning to me, and I hope we're transmitting resistance, resilience, and refusal.
Mariana Hirsch, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Columbia University Professor Emerita. Her recent piece in the foreword, "I grew up under a terrifying authoritarian regime. Mahmoud Khalil's arrest is right out of their playbook." That does it for our show. I want to wish a happy birthday to David Prude and a belated happy birthday to Matt Ealy. Our condolences to our executive director, Julie Crosby, on the passing of her aunt, and also to Nermeen Sheikh on the passing of her dad. I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
On average, every 6 days, a woman in Canada is killed by her intimate partner. The women in our communities deserve to feel safe from both emotional and physical abuse. They deserve men who control their anger. Most importantly, they deserve to know the people they love most will never hurt them. Men like me stand up to create a safer world for the women in our lives. And we're looking to men like you, the men who make up our communities, to join us. You can play an active part to end violence. Visit www.whiteribbon.ca.
Diverse, independent, yours. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, BC.
Radio Rewind.